Thank you for joining us. All right. My name is Adrienne Smith, and I'm with the Office on Women's Health. I'm glad to moderate this session, Using Gender to Fight Multiple Risks, HIV, STI Prevention for Girls at Risk for Juvenile Delinquency. I am a public health advisor with the Office on Women's Health, which is within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and this is one of our grant initiatives, commonly known as our Girls at Risk Project. And we have our presenter, Dr. Jessica Johnson, and I'll introduce her in a minute, but that's me also. We have no disclosures to inform you of. So for this session, learning objectives, we will present information that will help you identify common protective and risk factors for HIV and STIs and juvenile delinquency among girls. We will review gender-responsive strategies that are integrated into HIV prevention programs for at-risk girls. List three potential outcomes of HIV prevention programs for girls at risk for juvenile delinquency, and discuss the strengths and challenges with implementing intensive intervention modules. So just the program overview and more about our office. Our office is within the Office of the Secretary and then within the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Health and Human Services. Our mission is to provide leadership to promote health equity across the lifespan for women and girls through sex and gender-specific approaches. We have so many programs in our office, and you can look our office up on our website, womenshealth.gov, and then we also have girlshealth.gov. But in particular, this project was really looking at the intersection of violence and HIV and girls who will be at risk. OWH really wanted to examine in our portfolio of girls prevention programs how HIV and violence intersect, and use that in the context of a program that was comprehensive, that was intensive, that was gender specific, really looking at the challenges and the issues that center around girls and their lives and their sociology in the community, that was culturally specific. In many cases, the girls were girls who were minority ethnic population, developmentally appropriate, something that was age appropriate and it suited them where they were in their lives, and that incorporated community events and how the community could really get a better understanding of HIV, of STIs, violence, and how they impacted the community at large. All right, so I want to introduce our speaker. We have Dr. Jessica Johnson. Dr. Jessica Johnson has a doctoral degree in applied social psychology with expertise in program evaluation. Her work focuses on applying principles of behavior change to research and evaluating public health programs and initiatives. During her doctoral studies, Jessica was a researcher and evaluator for community-based HIV prevention initiatives for women and youth, including a culturally tailored HIV prevention program implemented in middle schools in an inner-city district, school district. For the Girls at Risk at Greater Risk Project, she serves as an evaluator and is responsible for all tasks related to the outcome evaluation and providing evaluation technical assistance to the grantees. Dr. Jessica Johnson. And while she's coming, I do want to say, I want to give a special thank you to APHA, even though he's not here, and Mr. Mighty Fine, who helped us coordinate this session for our office. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrienne. So the purpose of the program was to increase HIV prevention and to reduce the risk of contracting HIV with girls aged 9 to 17 who were considered at risk for juvenile delinquency. So this is a list of the core elements. As Adrian mentioned, we wanted this program to be comprehensive. And as you see, we have a host of risk and protective factors. Those elements that are underlined were only covered with 12 to 17 girls. We didn't feel it was developmentally appropriate to cover with the girls in the 9-11 age group. So in addition to HIV delinquency and sexual risk behaviors, we also chose to cover a range of risk factors and protective factors that risk factors mostly that co-occur with both, and that includes substance use, fighting, aggression, and several different types of violence. Our grantees in their programs, not only did they take into context the social context where their programs were and the culture, and they did this by covering topics like neighborhood violence, gangs, sexual and dating violence, physical and emotional abuse. Under protective factors, they were required to have sessions on gender and societal norms. And as we'll see later on, they covered different aspects of this. We'll discuss that later on in the slide. They were all required to cover self-esteem and depression. Life skills includes problem solving, conflict resolution, coping, and healthy relationships, mostly focused on peers and dating. And so this list, GEARS worked with the grantees to basically come up with this final list. So the grantees were involved in choosing what they were going to cover, as well as the intensity. And so the OWH wanted the program also to be intensive, and as you see, this intervention was pretty long. The core intervention was 9 months, and it basically followed the school calendar year. Several of our programs were implemented in schools. Some were also after school. So the grantees met weekly with the girls. The first three sessions were mostly topic-oriented, and the last meeting was a community event. So again, we see the emphasis on the community and social context. From research, we know that booster sessions are very important to increase in the retention and the retention of the skills and the knowledge that they learned. So after the 9-month core intervention, the grantees held 6 monthly sessions, essentially booster sessions. The first 3 sessions were on HIV, STI, self-esteem, and either violence or delinquency, and then they chose the topics of the last 3. Because of developmental appropriateness, they implemented the program in 2 separate groups. One group was 9-11 and the other group 12 to 17. And so OWH also gave the grantees flexibility to tailor the program to their particular population. All of the grantees were required to choose evidence-based HIV prevention curricula, and so they chose what curricula was best for their population. Almost all of them tailored this curricula to their to the culture, the racial and ethnic makeup of the girls. They were allowed to choose which gender-specific strategies, and some chose to emphasize specific topics. We had several grantees that chose to emphasize dating violence, and several chose to emphasize mental health and depression. So the core elements and the structure make up the program model. Now we're going to talk about the grantees and how they implemented the program. So this is a list of the 10 grantees that were chosen. All of the grantees had 12 to 17 groups, and the grantees with the stars also had 9-11 groups. Most of our grantees, 7 of them, work with African American girls. Sage Associates, that location was actually at an American Indian boarding school. Orange County Bar Foundation worked with Latino girls, and West Care was our Pacific Islander site. And most of the programs also were implemented in urban areas. So all of the grantees were required to use evidence-based HIV prevention curricula. Actually, all of them adapted the curricula, and they used more than one. They used additional curricula for violence and delinquency. Some chose curricula related to some of those protective factors like depression and self-esteem. And some chose curricula or models specifically designed for girls. So this is a list of the evidence-based HIV prevention curricula used in the programs, and this is from CDC's HIV prevention compendium. The first group of programs were all developed for African Americans. SISTA is a session for, is a program for women. The grantee adapted it for girls. Be Proud, Be Responsible is a program for males. They adapted it for females. Street Smart is a program for runaway youth, and Voices is a program developed for African American and Latino youth. In addition to the evidence-based curricula, the grantees also chose to supplement it with others. The first two of these programs are well-known abstinence-based education programs. Aben Aya is a program developed based on Ghanaian principles developed for African American youth in grades 5th through 8th grade. FLASH, Family Life and Sexual Health, is a program developed for middle and high school youth, and it incorporates gender principles, gender discussions. Okay, so now we're going to talk more about the gender responsive strategies the grantees use. As I mentioned before, they were able to choose their own. OWH's definition of gender responsive are strategies that address the range of societal beliefs, norms, customs, practices that define masculine and feminine characteristics and behaviors. So we collected data on gender responsive strategies through 10 interviews with program directors and 10 interviews with program staff. Program staff included facilitators and program coordinators. So these individuals were first asked about the most important components of their program, and then they were asked which of these components were gender specific and why were they chosen. And what we found was that they used multiple strategies and that a lot of these strategies overlapped. One strategy was to design the program for females. Several of the programs had all female staff. A couple of them had mentorship programs where they matched the girls with women in the community. They chose curricula and models designed specifically for females, and all of them worked really hard to foster a sense of cohesion based on being a girl. Another strategy, obviously, is to use those gender-specific topics in addition to the core elements that were chosen. Two of our grantees focus on condom negotiation skills. Some of them focus on feminine hygiene and sexual health. Our programs also included components that address the psychological aspects of being a girl. Two of our grantees used a female empowerment approach. Within this required session on gender and society, they talked about gender roles, power imbalances, and female images in the media. In addition to self-esteem, they talked about self-efficacy and self-assertiveness. And as we know, gender norms vary by social context as well as culture, and so a lot of the grantees integrated gender discussions with culture. So, for example, instead of talking about what it means to be a girl, they talked about what does it mean to be a Native American girl, an African American girl, etc. And in their adaptations of the curricula, they included points of view from African American women and images and videos of women and girls from their culture. One important strategy that all of them used was to include a female or gender in the branding, so the program names and the logos. And so as you see here, you can tell from the names, GLAM, as well as some of the acronyms that several of these strategies kind of spoke to the psychological aspects of being a girl, self, motivation, strength, self-esteem. And here are some of the logos. that they used. The logo on the right was actually a piece of artwork developed by one of the girls, and the program chose to use that as their logo. And another strategy that's not on the slide that was pretty important is, as you remember, they met monthly with the girls. The first 3 weeks were sessions. The last week was a community event. And several of these community events were tailored to girls as well. They had slumber parties. They hosted proms. One of the programs to increase retention of the girls had a dance team. And so this was very important strategy, not only for gender, but also marketing themselves and recruiting other girls. So now we're going to cover the outcomes. I'm only going to focus on the most significant outcomes. Our evaluation of the program consisted of a process evaluation that was focused on program implementation, as well as an outcome evaluation. And so today we're just going to focus on the outcome evaluation. So we used the repeated measures designed. Data were collected four time points, and we collected data on all of those core elements. And we did it before the core intervention, immediately after the core intervention, after those booster sessions, and 3 months after the supplemental period. Our grantees, they first did a pilot of their programs, and then afterwards they collected three cohorts of data. So they did this for three groups of girls. Today we're just going to focus on preliminary findings through cohort two supplemental. We're currently analyzing the data for all three cohorts. So our sample size for the 9-11 group, we had 238 girls. For the 12 to 17 group, one of the sites dropped out, so they're not included in this analysis. The total sample size is 1,328. Retention was a huge problem. As you can imagine, trying to get the girls to stay in the program for 9 months was challenging. We'll discuss those challenges and some of the solutions the grantees used towards the end of the presentation. For the 9-11 group at post-test, they retained 53% of the girls. The 12 to 17 group was a little bit better at 73%. And at supplemental, the retention was similar for both, around 25%. So because of the high dropout rate, we wanted to see if there were any main differences between the girls who dropped out and the girls who stayed through the supplemental time point. And our analysis showed that for the 9-11 group, the girls who dropped out had more favorable attitudes towards gangs. For the 12 to 17 group, they had a higher self-reported delinquency and lower safe sex intentions. And safe sex intentions is basically intentions to have protected sex. So now we're going to talk about a little bit more about who the girls were in the programs. We're required to report race and ethnicity using government categories, and the government defines ethnicity as either Hispanic or not Hispanic, and the racial groups include African American or Black, White, Hawaiian Pacific Islander, American Indian or Alaska Native, and Asian. So as we see here in the 9-11 group, the group was mostly African American and White, and 60% describe themselves as Hispanic or Latino. Our 12 to 17 group was a bit more diverse, less than half were African American, and 19% were American Indian. And then we see a pretty even mix of White, Asian, and Hawaiian and Pacific Islander. Several of the girls chose not to respond to the ethnicity category. So for age, our 9-11 group was around 10, fifth grade. Our 12 to 17 group, they were in between 14 and 15, which is around ninth grade. Most of them spoke English. Our 12 to 17 group, we had one site that was at a Native American boarding school. And for the 12 to 17 girls only, we asked about sexual orientation, and we found that 14% of the girls described themselves as orientation, not heterosexual, either unsure. Okay, sex behaviors were only asked of 12 to 17 girls, and at baseline, 40% of the girls had ever had sex. 16% were sexually active, meaning that they had sex in the past 30 days, and the average age of initiation was almost 14. Past 30-day condom use, we use this as a proxy for sex risk. At baseline, before the intervention, 45% of the girls reported that they use condoms all the time, but as you see, only 22% said they use them almost never. Delinquency behaviors, actually the incidence of recent fighting was the same, almost the same for 9/11 and 12 to 17 groups, and gang intentions and membership were pretty low. For substance use, of course we expect the 12 to 17 girls to have engaged in more than the 9/11. About a third of the girls had tried alcohol, and around a quarter had tried cigarettes and marijuana. So now we're going to cover the outcomes over time. I'm going to cover the findings, the significant findings at post-test and at supplemental, but remember at supplemental we only could retain a quarter of the girls, so these findings are only for those who remained in the program. I'm going to review them in four main categories: HIV, STIs, delinquency, dating violence, and mental health and well-being. So for this first category of HIV, STI outcomes, at post-test and supplemental, HIV knowledge increased significantly for both groups. At supplemental, for those girls who remained, sex intentions decreased, and sex risk also significantly decreased. So here we see HIV knowledge over time for 9/11 girls. The scale used for HIV knowledge for 9/11 girls was a 7-item basic HIV knowledge scale. And as we see it post-test, the percentage of knowledge increased by 18% and continued to increase at supplemental. The scale used for 12 to 17 girls was actually a comprehensive scale. It included basic HIV knowledge, advanced HIV knowledge, and knowledge of sexually transmitted infections. And again, we see the same trend that it increased at post-test and continued to increase at supplemental. For delinquency, there were no post-test changes. There were no significant findings for delinquency-related outcomes at post-test. All of them were found for the girls who remained at supplemental. And at supplemental, we found that for both 9/11 and 12 to 17 groups, negative attitudes towards gangs increased. For this 12 to 17 groups, we saw that fighting, using violence and verbal aggression as a conflict tactic, they significantly decreased. Several of the programs also focused on dating violence, and we saw the effect in the outcomes. Again, dating violence was only covered with 12 to 17 girls. So the findings show that it significantly decreased at post-test and supplemental. This scale was a scale of self-reported victimization, and so the girls are reporting on their experiences with dating violence themselves. And so here we see the graph of the consistent trend of decreasing on self-reported dating violence. For mental health and well-being, at post-tests, we found that for the 12 to 17 group, authenticity, which is the ability to be your true self, significantly increased at post-tests. And for those girls who remained at supplemental, we see findings for self-esteem, depression, and for the 9/11 group body image. So this is the graph for authenticity over time. And as you see at post-test, it increases and increases slightly at supplemental. Although depression was not significant at post-test, we chose to include this graph. So we use the CES depression scale, which is most commonly used with adolescents. And in this scale, a score of 21 indicates major depression. a score of 15 to 21 indicates mild depression, and anything below means you're not depressed. And so as we see at baseline, the 12 to 17 girls came pretty close to that threshold of major depression. And at post-test and supplemental, they were more in that mild range, but still at supplemental, you see it's still not in the normal range. So our girls, in terms of risk, were high on depression. But as I mentioned before, several of our grantees emphasized that by including having mental health counselors as facilitators or having speakers come in and speak about depression and mental health, and having also additional services referrals. So our overall conclusions are that obviously the girls who dropped out were at higher risk. And for those girls who stayed in the program through supplemental, we saw several more significant outcomes. And also we saw more significant outcomes for those girls 12 to 17 instead of 9 to 11. And several of the outcomes show that at the supplemental time point, we didn't only maintain the effects, but in some cases we enhanced the effects. So HIV knowledge continued to increase. It just didn't stay the same. And our post-test findings after the nine-month intervention, we saw in areas of HIV knowledge, dating violence, and authenticity. And although the girls were at risk for juvenile delinquency, this finding of dating violence is pretty important in terms of policy, because we know that the 2010 PEPFAR really emphasized the intersection of HIV and gender-based violence. And you can kind of put dating violence in that category of gender-based violence. So now we're going to cover some best practices. So this was a very challenging for the grantees, and these are some of the points, or some of the take-home points, some of the things that they realized in implementing the programs that were important to implementing the programs. One is that it was important for the grantees to recognize the diversity within racial and ethnic groups. One of our sites in Florida was African American. However, within that, they had a lot of diversity. They had African, Caribbean, and Haitian. In the beginning of the program, they even had some girls who didn't completely speak English. And so they had to learn how to address that diversity and adapt it to their in their program. Also, community factors. Two of the programs consistently noted that violence in the community affected their program. So incidences of violence in the community spilled over into the schools. And also one site was working in a school that was consistently threatened with being shut down due to academic reasons. So this was another challenge. Two of our sites had challenges around religious beliefs around sex, and they were the Hispanic and Latino site and the Guam site, and they were mostly working in Catholic cultures, the cultures where Catholicism was pretty prevalent. While the program focused on delinquent girls, they chose which delinquent behaviors were more relevant to them. Some of them chose to focus on dating violence. Others chose to emphasize gangs. So when we talk about delinquency, it can include a lot of things, a lot of behaviors. They chose to emphasize what was specific to theirs. And also, they found out that girls like women have multiple roles, and so they found themselves offering more services like childcare. So several of the girls after school on the weekends were responsible for taking care of their siblings. So they said, we can't come to the program because we have to take care of our sister and brother. So they started offering babysitting. Similarly, in our Latino site, several of the girls served as translators for community, their family members as well. So again, we see this, like women, that they have multiple roles that competed with their attending the program. And the grantees for retention had to hold additional activities, events, and services to keep them coming. child care services, mental health services. And so now we're going to cover the strengths, and we're going to focus on the strengths of implementing an intensive intervention with an at-risk population. So one of the obvious strengths is that the programs, the grantees, had enough time to do basically everything they wanted. It's kind of like their dream, you know, all of the topics, all the risk and protective factors. And it was a lot of time for the staff to build relationships with the girls, to build bonds for the girls to learn. They were able to go over topics several times for retention. And also they built community awareness and supported the program. So by the end of the year, or in this case, they did three cohorts. So by the end of 3 years, the community knew about the GEMS program or the BLING program or the CHICAS program. And honestly, this intervention was comprehensive. As I mentioned before, they were able to implement a full model of several risk and protective factors. And in the design, we included booster sessions. So obviously, some of the challenges of implementing the intervention was it required more resources and support. So several of our grantees supplemented the funding from OWH with in-kind services and donations from community partners and nonprofits. It required more program staff, a lot more resources for recruitment and tracking, keeping up with the girls, trying to identify reasons why they were going to drop out and mitigate them. And it required support from their community partners, their community sites. So they implemented the program in schools, both public schools and alternative schools, community sites like the Boys and Girls Clubs, juvenile justice facilities, really churches, really a range of sites. And so these sites, they required a lot of support for them throughout the three-year period. And they've, as I said before, they found themselves providing additional services for the girls. Our Native American site at the boarding school was able to get a mental health counselor at the boarding school to refer the girls to. And they had to host special events, not only for retention, but to build community support. And so what they did, especially in terms of partnerships, was attend networking events, hold fundraising events. For COF, they hired interns to do some of the data entry part of it. They chose low-cost, effective activities, and some of them chose to limit the number of participants. So we're only going to have 10 girls because that's what we can support. Obviously, it was difficult to recruit the girls to the program because it was so intensive. The girls had other competing activities, especially if it was after school on the weekends. The girls, they really had to make a compelling case for why they would come to the program instead of hang out with their families or friends. It was a long program, and for those programs that were in the school, the girls basically had to choose to go to this program instead of lunch or their PE period. So what the grantees did was they used past graduates to recruit. They held special opportunities for the participants. One of the grantees had a dance team, so the girls really wanted to get on the dance team, so they came to the program. They recruited from other programs, and they recruited through partnerships. So once the girls got into the programs, they were very difficult to stay because the girls are at risk for delinquency. They had a high truancy rate. Some of the girls transferred out to alternative schools. They were placed in in-school suspension. One of our sites had an unusually high mobility rate, which is the rate within the school of students transferring. So that was a problem. In the beginning, our grantees recruited those older girls, but then they found that when they graduated, they were hard to retain. And also, transportation was a huge issue, getting the girls to the program and funding that. And as I mentioned before, these competing roles in the home. So to address this, several of the programs changed the program location. So they changed it from the community to the school so they wouldn't have to worry about transportation or attendance. To address the issue of girls graduating, they recruited younger girls. So by the end of the school year and through the follow-up period, they would still be in the school system. They created partnerships for transportation, church vans for a specific Islander site. They had cabs and taxis. And they added or changed their implementation sites. If the site was in an area that was that had a high incidence of violence, they changed it for safety reasons. They offered other services and incentives such as food, prizes, raffles. And they partnered with the schools to minimize suspensions. At one location, the program was implemented in the schools, and instead of suspending the girls, if they knew they were in the program, they would actually contact the facilitator and was like, you know, hey, Monique is about to be suspended. So it kind of served as a, you know, an alternative to in-school suspension. And to keep the girls engaged, they got really creative within the content of their programs, and as I mentioned before, they were able to adapt it as they felt. So they included role-playing, emphasized skills. Two of our sites had an empowerment model, so they really focused on the delivery of it, including creative activities that involve the arts and having speakers and incentives. So our recommendations for future programming is to focus on that 12 to 17 group, the middle and high school populations. Retention and tracking was a huge problem, so providing funding specifically for retention and trafficking a full-time staff member, and providing grantees with workshops on recruitment and retention and training during the planning period. We did this with the grantees. We had recruitment and retention workshops where they were able to figure out in their own sites what are our issues and what are our solutions, and then later up followed up with them to see if it was really working. And also, within our grantees, there was a pretty high amount of staff turnover. Especially within the evaluation team that was responsible for data entry and data collection. And so our recommendation is, you know, moving forward, when we do trainings, when we do this evaluation technical assistance, to use the trainer models so that the staff who are there can train new staff as they come on board, and also to share to use webinars of the trainings and share them on the site so that if somebody comes in year two, they have the training and it's easy for them to catch up. And also in the grant announcements in the RFP to assess how ready they are to implement the program, specifically recruitment, retention, and transportation. While those were the three consistent barriers that we saw throughout the project, even after providing technical assistance. Okay, so this is our program. Thank you very much for coming, even though it was the last day early in the morning. So we can have questions or discussions around this. Since we have a small group, we can make it, you know, informal. Hopefully that if you have programs, or if you work with girls or HIV or STI education, hopefully this information kind of helped you. We can talk more about the program or other efforts in the office. Sure.
Very interesting presentation.
Sure.
I have a couple questions. Did you all create the 7-item HIV knowledge field, or did you use an existing one? And the same with the dating violence
field. I can get you more information on the scale. The dating violence scale was a self-reported victimization scale. I believe it was a 14-item scale. And the HIV knowledge scale with the 9/11 group, it was 7 items. Just to say basic HIV knowledge, the 12 to 17 group, it was a compilation of 3 different scales measuring basic, advanced, redesigned their program. So those three weekly sessions, they chose the topics of this program.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so it's a combination of those curriculum and other activities that they did.
The other, most of the activities were content specific except for that community event.
Okay.
The community event was basically the additional activity.
Challenges getting buy-in from schools and communities up front. It sounds like towards the end there wasn't any pushback. Was there any sort of challenges initially?
I'm not aware up front if there were any challenges. I do know that those two sites, the Latino setting and the specific Islander sites, and may have had some challenges because they were in a setting that was sensitive around sex issues, especially with girls 9-11 and 12 to 17. The way they addressed that challenge was because the program was so comprehensive, they marketed it and pitched it as a program for girls that covers almost everything.
So it kind of sounded like the individual sites might have had their own evaluations as well, and so is there any way to get information on maybe the group that used SISTA, what were their outcomes versus the group that used some other group? Mm-hmm. Is that available yet?
Yeah, from the preliminary outcomes from this data through Cohort 2 Supplemental, we did do analysis by grantee. And this round, we're going to look more at that because obviously some programs emphasize certain sessions and topics over others.
Okay.
So to look at those outcomes and then look at the program implementation and see how they match up.
Okay.
So did those programs to emphasize depression have more depression outcomes? So we're currently wanting to look at that.
Okay. But it's not available yet.
No.
But we can get your information as we, we're finishing up the evaluation contract of this project. And, you know, as we have more information, we can, you know, contact you and make sure, you know, even, so GEARS, Jessica was a part of our evaluation team. So then we have the actual grantees who work. So if you want some, like, some information or maybe some of the challenges to each of the sites and how they got into the schools and how they really built their programs, we can follow up with some of the grantees and get back with you on maybe some of the things that, you know, made it hard for them to get into the schools, or what that implementation or what that process was like to even be able to partner with the school. Because we know maybe some cases it was easy, but I'm sure that took some time, and maybe some of them already had some partnerships, because most of the grantees are already established organizations. Maybe they had some partnerships already in place where they are. But we know that sometimes getting in schools, especially to talk about anything around sex, we know that sometimes that can be challenging. But as we get information, we're finishing up the overall evaluation, but we can definitely, you know, I can get your information and we can connect with you to see how we can get that to help support what you're doing.
But yeah, to add more to your question about the local evaluation, the grantees up front from the RFP were required to have an evaluator. So they did their own data collection, and they entered the data into a portal. And from there is where GEARS downloaded the data for the evaluation. And then in our evaluation technical assistance, you know, we provided assistance on all those things for the grantees. Found in terms of funds, even though they had an evaluator, they could only use it for analysis. So in doing the data collection and entry, a lot of our technical assistance was on that. So in terms of support and their local evaluation, yeah, a lot of support.
So my question for you is, do you anticipate another round where you have a call for other programs that might want to participate the next time around?
I think we are working on that.
Okay.
Because we know there's a need, especially for this age group, and there was a great response. And then we can look at some of that data and see where, for a particular population, where there's certain curricula, certain modules that work best. Maybe we can streamline it more if it's better to, you know, not leave it flexible, but kind of see that we get some better results for certain things. Maybe we can capture that. So we'll look at the data and see, but that's where we want to go, is to kind of look at the results and see how we can shape it even better based on some of the practices that we found to be, you know, work out better from this round.
And would that be on your website if you have another round?
Yes. If it's a grant, it'll be on grants.gov. Contracts usually go on federalbusinessopportunities.gov. So those are the, you know, two sites. But, you know, if you can check those and then put in some of the keywords, girls or HIV education, that sort of thing, if you work in those fields, and check out funding.
Sites where they had that listed up in their programs, and they were able to pick lessons from all those different programs to implement, or did they have to pick one of those programs to then implement?
So they were able to choose their own program. So that slide was a list of different the programs that different grantees chose to use.
Gotcha. Okay. So they would pick one of those programs.
So it was more a compilation of what they used.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. So the other question I had, so you're suggesting we sort of doing more of this, but targeting the older population. Is there any thought about looking, maybe not necessarily from the HIV-STI perspective, but more from the juvenile delinquency truancy perspective, at trying to target different interventions to the younger group? So a lot of the problem with retention and dropout rates has to do with some of these other delinquency issues. Mm-hmm. Is there a thought about trying to target some sort of intervention even earlier to try to prevent that
from happening? That's a good idea. We should look at that even earlier. See how we take. We need to look at some literature and look at that. I appreciate that suggestion.
Sure.
It makes sense to kind of go even before we get to this point, see how we can.
Yeah, I
don't
know. Yeah, I have no idea if that's
anything
out there.
Like what age group?
Have
you experienced any?
I haven't. And I mean, I think some of the, especially some of the cultural societal challenges, it's cultural societal norms are hard to.
It would be interesting based on those depression results to kind of see how that,
right.
Like, what is that about for this age? I mean, how could you really, and you know, I'm not really sure, you know, what was going on to make those results as far as that depression scale like that, but we may need to look at that and see what kind of stressors or environment or what, you know, what the girls were dealing with.
Some of them knew they were in programs, some of them were involved.
much were parents involved, and then how that made them.
Right, yeah, exactly. And then would that parental involvement lead to better outcomes?
Preteens, adolescents, how can you really build
the exchange and relationship to talk. So then when these types of challenges come up, you can have an open communication channel with the child, because they know it gets kind of funny sometimes in those teen years. Sometimes they don't want to talk to you, even though they do want to talk to you. How to bring out information sometimes becomes a challenge.
Provides the parents an opportunity to be more involved in what their child is consuming, but also gives them potentially an avenue to start having those conversations without having to worry about it turning into what they did or using themselves as examples. It gives them an example that their child is already dealing with to start having. That might be a place to start. Again, it doesn't necessarily help to build those communication skills, but again, it might give them a place to, and this could go for examples of either healthy or unhealthy activities that you can do.
And learn the new text language in a little short.
Yeah.
So well, maybe send them a text since everybody texts, you know.
Right. Yeah. I think also to just impressing upon them that it isn't a one-time conversation, right? It's not. I think a lot of people still look at it as this, especially when it comes to sex,
the talk.
Right, but you know, it really should be. And I think the research suggests this as well. It really should be more. It really should be broken down into smaller pieces. And I think that again, my personal opinion, but I think that helps. Relationship between the parent and child as well, because oftentimes it's so challenging for both people to have the conversation.
Right. Ongoing communication. Any other comments?
Well, this has been helpful for me. I've been culturally adapting HIV risk behaviors for substance abusing adult women. And we just got a small local funds to try to culturally adapt it for teen girls in a subsidized housing area. And so I've learned some things today about different things to consider when you're going from one population to another, that for substance abusing women, at least they're going to be around that clinic for a while and mandated the treatment, and so they may be easier to catch up with them than when you're talking about the retention of the girls, that we might have to add activities for these girls as volunteers. And then our discussion about we're wondering what to do around, but we knew we needed to do something around mother and child communication, so it's helpful to hear that discussion as well.
They have the women to bring their daughters, but they have them in that age range, so they get also there at the same time.
I'm not sure if it's appropriate or not. I've always found people coming back.
And we talked about that in another session, like for just public health programs and interventions anyway. Like what you know, incentives are the key, you know.
Yeah.
Because I mean, just because we think we have something great to offer, mm-hmm. we have to make sure, you know, how do you get them back? And, you know, maybe by the end they realize, oh, this changed my life or this was made a difference, but you know, you gotta have incentives that whatever that means.
Sounds like a creative incentive too, that they might come back.
Dance team, and proms, slumber parties. I mean, stuff that you would think that would be fun for girls, period,
and ask them. We said always ask, you know, the people who, what do you want, what will bring you, and get their peers in, and use that peer influence. But, right, to get participation, you have people come to something, you have to have incentives.
Yeah.